I thought this morning I would share with you some thoughts about the topic of human nature. And not that I have any definitive final say on the topic, but perhaps it will stimulate you to think a little bit more about your concepts of human nature and maybe have some interesting discussions about it with other people. I believe that everyone has some kind of concept of what human nature is like, even if we don't use that expression, human nature. It could be that it's kind of subconscious or unthought about, but some understanding of what it means to be a human being that goes into decisions we make about what is important for us in our lives, decisions of what we do or what we don't do. And you find in history of religions, in history of Buddhism, different ideas about the innate qualities of a human being, the essential qualities or core nature of what it means to be human. And in the history of Buddhism, there's been a variety. One, in the early Buddhist tradition, one of the core aspects was the potential to be enlightened. And that enlightenment, that liberation, came from the human capacity to train ourselves. We can train, we can develop the mind, the heart. It's something that can be developed. And with effort, we can develop ourselves so to create those conditions that allows liberation to happen. A very strong current of Buddhist thought on human nature in East Asian Buddhism, in China in particular, and even more so in Japan, has the view that human nature is what it is, but it's limited by the conditions of the times that we live in. And in the first 500 years, in the time of the Buddha afterwards, the conditions were right for people to be able to train, develop themselves, and become awakened on their own effort. But about 500 years after the Buddha lived, the universe, the world system we're in, entered into the degenerate age. And in this age that we're currently living in, according to this view, it's no longer possible for anybody to kind of cultivate and develop themselves. And in fact, to try to do that, represents a form of egotism, self-centeredness, that actually stands in the way of some kind of real transformation. And in this view, which is quite popular in East Asian Buddhism, the only way to get liberated, you can't do it on your own effort, is by using an other power. And the other power is a cosmic Buddha named Amida Buddha. And so it's a little bit of somewhat like Protestant Christianity, where grace comes, grace doesn't come from your good works, it comes, grace, it isn't that your good works that counts, it's the grace that comes from the divine. That's particularly East Asian, that particular kind of East Asian Buddhism is called Pure Land Buddhism. And it's produced some very transformed people, because there's something very deep surrender that can happen. Surrender of self that, done the right way, can certainly make a beautifully peaceful person. And then you have also in Mahayana Buddhism, you have the idea of Buddha nature, that human nature is characterized, humans are characterized by having something called Buddha nature, which is a very tends to be a very positive view of human beings, that somehow we have inside of us perhaps a kernel or a seed. Or some people, in some Mahayana beliefs, it's like somehow in us there is this thing, like a soul almost, that's called Buddha nature. Other Mahayanists, to go along with the traditional Buddhist idea that there is no soul, will say, well, it's not a seed per se, but it's a potential. And we all have that potential. And some people say it has to be trained and developed. But it gives a very positive view of human life. And the teachings about Buddha nature usually come along with some sense that there's a kind of sense of benign operation, a kind of a innate movement within the human psyche, human heart, towards the good, towards liberation, something that's quite beautiful. And this, some people like to contrast this with certain religious teachings, that especially outside of Buddhism, that human nature, there's something fundamentally wrong with human beings, and our core nature has something off. Somehow eating apples has a lot to do with this. And so there's much more to it than that, of course. But I shouldn't take it lightly. But some idea that something off, sinful nature or something. And you find people then who will contrast Buddhism with other religions, saying that Buddhism has this idea of innate beauty or sacredness in the human heart, as opposed to others who see there's something fundamentally wrong with us and we have to be saved from the outside or we have to repent or do something. So, what do you believe? So who are we? You know, what is our potential? If you believe that we can be trained, that we can develop ourselves, then people will apply themselves to that effort. If you believe that your capacities are fixed, then there's no need to train and you are what you are. I read recently a study, a psychologist at Stanford, who described people's mindsets of people who are actually quite skilled in something, like really good athletes. And there's a culture in certain fairly athletic world these days, top athletic world, that your feeling is you're born being a great athlete. And so you don't have to really train. And in fact, to train kind of shows that maybe you're not so great. And so they just show up on the field to play. They don't want to do practice and all that. And there was an English soccer team that was apparently brought to Stanford to meet with her to try to get some of these top people out of that mindset. And now when they choose soccer players in England, apparently, one of the things they're interviewing is how they understand their own capacity. And if they feel their capacity is set, they're born with this great innate capacity, maybe they're not so interested in having them on the team, even though they're great athletes. But if they have the mindset that they can, through effort, develop themselves, that then they're much more interested to have on the team, and so they'll search for people who can grow and develop. I had a class in college it was anthropology class or history class on utopian communities, and I remember almost nothing of it. We studied the Mennonites and the Amish and all kinds of places, and except for one thing that the professor said, maybe in passing, he said the students he had who tended to do the best work, were usually not the brightest, but rather the ones who persevered, the ones who put in a lot of effort, who just kind of hung in there and kept working at it, and they tended to do the best work. And since I wasn't a great student, I thought that was really great. It was really good news to me. So the idea of, you make effort, you have to kind of work at it. And part of my not being a good student days, when I started graduate school, I didn't know how to write. I had never really written anything seriously. I went through, it's kind of like I went through the California education system, and which I kind of, I don't know, it didn't teach me much about writing. I went through the UC California system, 4 years of it, and didn't learn much about writing. I wrote one term paper on the intensive cultivation of apple trees. So I got to graduate school and in the humanities, and you expected to write a lot. The first semester there, I had to write two-page papers every week. Now, for some people, that's easy. I had an office mate in that time. He would come to class Monday. It was due Monday. He would come to class to the office Monday morning, sit down on the typewriter back then, and type out his essay and turn it in. Just, one, two, three, it was done. I just spent the whole weekend. The whole weekend, these two pages. And my wife, you know, she helped me. She helped me edit. She'd look at the first papers and say, "Gil, where did you go to school?" And so, but now people tell me that I can write pretty well. I still get a lot of help from people, and certainly it's changed a lot over the years. And but the reason I'm telling the story was that I had a professor who also seemed to write these great academic papers. And the academic papers had this quality of kind of reading a mystery novel. You know, she set up this kind of tension beginning. He really wanted to get to the end, you know, of this academic article because it was so compelling. And I was so in awe of her papers. And then one day she shared with me an early draft of one of her papers. And to my shock, it was crossed out and, you know, and mistakes and misspelling things. And I realized it didn't just come off her fingers, you know, all done. But she also spent a lot of time working on it, crafting it, making mistakes. And it took effort and time to develop. So that's, anyway, so the view, we have a view of nature. So the people, some people have various views of human nature that maybe are very personal. Well, other people can develop it, I can't. Other people can do something, but I really don't have the ability. And so it's self-limiting in some way. So Buddha nature is one idea that you find in some schools of Buddhism. And when I hear about Buddha nature, it occurs to me that that then it's a setup for the opposite, which in Buddhist terms would be Mara nature. And you don't hear Buddhists talk about Mara nature. It's so much. I never heard that expression before. Maybe I just coined it, Mara nature. Mara is kind of the Buddhist devil. There's more to it than that, but for that we'll just call it that. And without using that term, however, you find in Thai Buddhism, a very strong tendency to a teaching or understanding that within us there are defilements. Within us there are these toxins that operate. Within us are these poisons. Within us are these enemies to what's best for us. And that you have to, and you find some Thai teachers in particular talking about you need to be a warrior, you have to slay the inner enemies, and you have to kind of fight this battlefield in there. Because, you know, so rather than thinking what's inside is beautiful and, you know, the Buddha nature and all that, it's more in the sense that what's inside is dangerous. And you can cause a lot of, you know, it's very dangerous to yourself, maybe to other people as well. And in order to protect yourself from that danger, you have to do battle. People who've studied Thai Buddhism, practiced Thai Buddhism, and come to the West to teach, tend to drop that kind of language. And because in the West, there's a strong tendency, especially in California, to want to have a very positive image, view of human nature. Benign, you know, the universe is benign. And so the kind of idea that there's something Mara nature inside of us, you know, we put a big sign out in the front saying, "Come to IMS to destroy your defilements. We'll do away with your enemies in within." I suspect, you know, there would be two or three people here. But it's a view. This is another view of human nature that's you find currency in within Buddhism. One of the surprises to me, or one of the things I discovered over my lifetimes, a lot within practice itself, meditation practice and Buddhist practice, is there is that aspect of my life which I need to take responsibility for. And then there is something inside of me which, a variety of things which operate, there's impulses, momentums within me that have their own power, their own, set in motion their own things. And some of those are quite beautiful and some of those are not so beautiful. So, to give an example I gave yesterday, I noticed when I was a teenager, I would go skiing, school skiing trips, and weekend, I was skiing some during the winter. And I enjoyed it. And then it would be, you know, it wouldn't be ski season for the summer, spring, summer, fall. And then next winter I'd go skiing again. And I noticed that I was a better skier the first day of the winter season of skiing than had been the last day of the previous winter. And I thought it was kind of strange. You know, I hadn't skied all summer, but I'd become a better skier. And so it was something, some kind of processing, some kind of integration was going on within while I was not skiing. Somehow the skills that I was learning. And this is now relatively well known, that you can memorize things, you can develop a skill, and if you really want that skill and that memorization to really stick really deeply, it helps if you have a really good night's sleep. And because the mind somehow needs the time of sleep to integrate that, to process it, to do something with the mind does, so it kind of becomes a little more settled in there. So you have to do the effort to memorize, but how much of your effort is ultimately responsible for the memorization? I don't know what the percentage is between your efforts to memorize and your efforts to get a good night's sleep. You know, to allow something which is not your effort, something within you which is not your kind of self-directed willful effort, to operate. So also, when I started my Buddhist practice at Zen Center, I worked at the Tassajara Bakery, Zen Center's bakery, and I came in the afternoon to do the prep for the people who came in early in the morning to make the bread, and I would measure out all the dry and the wet ingredients for the bread and the cakes and stuff, and have a dry batch and a wet batch, and in the morning they come in early in the morning to all be ready for them. They dump it all together and they make bread. And I would do this for, you know, I did this for months, and you get into kind of a dance, a routine, kind of, it almost becomes, kind of a ritual almost. And then a few times I would, then in the morning I'd get up and go to Zazen, to Zen meditation, 5 o'clock in the morning. And a few times it happened, I was sitting there in meditation, minding my own mind, pretty calm, relaxed. I don't know, maybe I was not thinking about it much, maybe I was thinking about something else, but anyway, pretty settled. And then, boom, out of the blue, with no warning at all. So it wasn't like I was thinking about something was related or something. It kind of prompted just the salt. I had left out the salt in the dries. And in the Zen Center, in the Zen practice, when you sit, you've got to just sit until they ring the bell. So I couldn't just pop up and call the bakery and say, you know, the salt. I had to kind of sit there with all the feelings that came. What have I done, you know? And sit there with all that until I finally was released by the bell so I can go and call. But at that time it was always too late. But what they would do, Zen historically, and also maybe, I don't know if it's connected to the historical pattern, Zen has a aspect of it where if something doesn't quite fit, you just rename it so it fits. So you're not supposed to eat after 12 o'clock in traditional Buddhist monastic circles, but you're allowed certain medicines. And so in Zen monasteries, they don't eat dinner, but they have a medicine meal. And there's the east wing and the west wing of Zen temples, Zen monasteries, and one of the ones I trained in Japan was kind of built in such a way on the mountain that everything was reversed, and they still called that part of the building that was in the west was called the east wing because it all had still fit, you know. But so with the bread, they called it, they made it and put it out to sale at the bakery, and they called it saltless bread. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't. You know, a lot of people need low salt diets, so. So, you know, Ed Brown, who's the great cook at Tassajara, he told me once that once he burned the, I guess he was doing baked beans or something, and he burned them. So he called them barbecued beans. And people came down afterwards and asked for the recipe. So you see, what you call things are very important, including human nature. So then just suddenly this popped up out of me, this salt. Something was going on behind my conscious mind, some processing, some remembering, something. It just popped into my mind. Oh, salt. Some of you maybe have had important things happen in dreams, important understandings or something. Just happens that way sometimes. So there's a processing that goes on that's below often our conscious life. It's possible through things like meditation. There's a variety of self-reflective techniques to get below the conscious mind, but meditation is certainly one of them. You develop enough calm, enough concentration, and the ability to look, start seeing what goes on more. What we call subconscious. It isn't that it's unconscious, it's just that we don't see it very often. And sometimes it's quite humbling to realize how much of the subconscious world is influencing our choices and decisions. And some of that subconscious world is beautiful, and some of it's not so beautiful. Some of it's quite embarrassing, or worse, to see what's kind of driving us, our decisions and things like that. And then below the subconscious is there, you know, unconscious motivations or impulses or conditions that will allow things to happen. I'm fond of the analogy that cutting your finger. You can do it intentionally. You have a wart, you take it out, you know, or something. Or you cut yourself, you know, cooking or something. So you have a cut. And you, as the caretaker of that cut, have important responsibilities to make it heal well. And one of them is to keep it clean, and perhaps cover it so it, you know, stays clean, and create the right conditions for its healing. But you cannot orchestrate its healing. I think it's a very complicated physiological event, the healing of broken tissue, just like with my recent surgery. You know, it's very complicated. I could never have figured out the, you know, how to do it myself, to direct all those growth hormones and, you know, the immune system and the protein and the amino acids and, you know, all the stuff that has to happen. It's pretty complicated. Probably, you know, maybe it's too complicated even for some of these modern supercomputers. It's an amazingly complex phenomenon. So, you know, I have my responsibility to keep it clean, but 99.99% of the work is something that's innate in the human, part of the body's nature. When things are working relatively well, the nature of the body is to be self-healing. Is there something comparable in the mind or the heart? Does the heart or the mind have a self-healing movement? Or in Buddhist terms, does it have a self-liberating movement? And if you don't believe in that, if you believe that there's no innate movement towards spiritual healing or psychological healing or movement towards liberation, then you would probably have a spiritual teaching that puts the emphasis on a lot of effort, a lot of diligent effort. Some people with this kind of view will put very strong emphasis on the importance of being vigilant and being on lookout for all the different defilements, all the different kind of unhealthy movements of the mind, to keep them at bay, to stop them, to prevent them from operating. It's all about self-control, self-restraint. That kind of language becomes really strong, developing strength. If you do believe in some innate movement towards psychological healing or spiritual liberation or something, then the language of "it's up to me" all the is not going to be as strong, and rather the language of letting go becomes strong. Letting go, you can get out of the way so something can operate. And this is not necessarily just the Buddhist dichotomy, because if you read the very famous, one of the most famous books of American psychology, The Varieties of Religious Experience, by who? William James, right. He makes this distinction. as well, and talks about people have a positive view of human nature, then it teaches that teachings, practices of letting go, we let go into it. And I've certainly seen in myself over and over again movements like that, where somehow I can't take responsibility for the inner psychological healing or movement that happens. Sometimes I'm surprised, just like with the salt, boom, you know, there it is. Sometimes I've been, boom, you know, oh my God, I didn't know that about myself. You know, suddenly this guy's, or oh, I didn't know those, I was doing that kind of behavior. I didn't know what those consequences are. You know, so some aspect of myself was not so healthy. Suddenly just kind of, without warning, kind of hits me like a truck. That's happened. What set that up? What are the conditions that allowed that to happen, that revelation to happen? And I've had the opposite happen where, you know, quite often in meditation, for example, where I have to do my effort, I have to keep the wound clean, I have to be present and not irritated anymore. But then I've watched various things be healed, moved through me, settled, relaxed. Even something like getting concentrated. You find some Buddhist teachers who will emphasize that you're responsible for your concentration. You have to make your effort. It's up to you. And I found it for myself, it might be well true for them, but I found for myself that concentration is not something I have a lot of control over. I create the conditions for concentration. And then sometimes I get concentrated and sometimes I don't. I create the conditions for healing the cut. And I imagine sometimes it doesn't heal. So you get adept over time with creating the right conditions. And then over and over again, you know, I set these conditions up, and then at some point, something seems to shift inside of me. And, how did that shift happen? That's not exactly like I'm doing it. Something inside of me is allowed to move and develop. Same thing with the movement of both getting being really still in meditation, letting go of thoughts, letting go of concerns and preoccupations, settling, letting go. I found repeatedly that as I let go more and more deeply, I tend to feel more and more peaceful, more still, more quiet. And then really beautiful parts of who I am seem to, you know, have a chance to come up. And I've known parts, there are parts of myself I didn't know about that I only discovered through meditation practice by having this deep letting go and simplicity of mind that allowed for something quieter or subtler, but also quite profound to show itself. One of those things for me was loving kindness practice, the spirit of loving kindness, of love. I was not at all interested in loving kindness practice when I was introduced to Buddhism. And when I came around circles in Buddhism where they taught loving kindness practice, the teachers would do guided loving kindness meditation, I would tune them out. I came from a Zen tradition before, and Zen was tough and, you know, and kind of just give me the absolute. And this love stuff was kind of sappy. And so I just tuned the teachers out, ignored the whole loving kindness bit, until my mind became still enough. There's a lot of letting go, a lot of release, a lot of the armor of the heart, the tensions, settle away. And lo and behold, bubbling up in my heart came this really strong, powerful sense of loving kindness. I wasn't trying to make it happen. It wasn't like I was willing it or training myself to have it. It was just kind of that, you know, as my heart became more tenderized, that's what came up. That's what arose. So with those kinds of experiences, it would be easy for me to say, perhaps, there's this beautiful Buddha nature inside of us. There's an innate movement towards liberation within us. The human nature in its essence is this beautiful thing. It moves towards healing, towards liberation, to freedom. Even the movement towards the very deep letting go of spiritual liberation in Buddhism. It's classically understood in Buddhism that you cannot make it happen yourself. You can go only so far yourself, but at some point, there has to be some other thing, something else operating, some deep insight or some deep letting go that you can't exactly orchestrate yourself. And so to have some experience like that, there's some very deep transformation that you can't take credit for. lends itself to the idea, oh, there's something really beautiful. Human nature in its essence is really beautiful if you give it a chance. However, there's also Mara nature. And I've been in situations where, you know, given the right conditions, there's innate impulses that I don't want to take credit for, rather not take credit for, that you know, I'm embarrassed to tell you about. For example, in my ambition to do a lot in one day, I might schedule myself really tight. And then I get, you know, a little bit harried with, you know, get behind in my schedule and driving around. And with a really tight schedule, that can be the condition for me to get irritated with other drivers. That, you know, I set up those conditions. If I set up the conditions to actually make space in my schedule, so I can get there, you know, make a lot of space so that I always have schedule, in my schedule enough time to get there early, then all the drivers are beautiful. Regardless if they cut me off. And so some people, the conditions of their social life, their family life, the world around them have been awful. And they live under tremendous stress, abuse, trauma. And those can be the conditions for impulses, sometimes self-protective impulses, sometimes coping impulses, that end up looking quite ugly, quite dangerous to themselves and to other people. Because within us, there's, you know, all kinds of impulses. There's impulses towards love, and there's impulses to hate. There's impulses towards generosity, and there's impulses towards greed and miserliness or something. There's impulses towards delusion. There's impulses to wisdom and insight. So I'm going to have to get to my view of human nature as it is right now. If we're going to use language like Buddha nature, then I think we should use language like Mara nature. But I don't like using language of Mara nature. So maybe we don't have to use that language of Buddha nature either. We don't have to use either one. The Buddha didn't use either one. He did a whole, you know, whole religious teaching without kind of pointing this is the true nature of who we are. But rather to recognize that within us there are forces that come with being a human being. And impulses, patterns, develop, you know, things that can happen. And which of those impulses get the upper hand has really big consequences. And so maybe we can't take ultimate responsibility in some way. Maybe we can. The issue of responsibility is an important one. But I think what we can do, and this is where we are responsible, is what are the conditions we put into place. We can decide which direction we want our life to go in, and then we can try to put together the best conditions to try to make it possible for a certain thing to happen. If you want to heal your cut, you keep the cut clean. If what you want is an infection, then you keep the cut dirty. You know, that's pretty easy. So it's a pretty complicated biological event to get an infection as well. So, you know, we don't take responsibility for actually getting it, except that we create the conditions for it. Same thing for our heart. Do we create the conditions? What are the conditions we're creating? The conditions we create affect how the heart develops, what impulses, what development, what evolution happens within our own heart. And maybe we can't take ultimate responsibility in the sense of we're the ones doing it and making it happen, but we can take responsibility for making sure the right conditions are there. So Buddhism, you know, encourages a lot of different putting into place conditions. One of them is precepts. Living by the precepts, living in an ethical way. That tends to put together conditions that minimize the degree of suffering that we're going to have and other people are going to have, but also minimize the tendency towards certain kinds of impulses getting the upper hand. and encourage, you know, more beneficial, beautiful qualities getting the upper hand. Living a life which is, you know, having meditation as part of your life is one of those conditions that can be very helpful. Meditation is very inefficient for most people. And I like to think that the spiritual life is very inefficient. And people who want things, you know, right away, you know, the instant enlightenment, or they want to see the results right away, it's very inefficient. So there's a story of a Zen monk, a young, extremely capable, successful young man who comes to the Zen monastery, intelligent, capable in many ways. And he's on fire to get enlightened. And he asks the abbot, "How long do I have to practice here until I get enlightened?" And the abbot says, "Oh, probably about 10 years. "Oh, but you know, I'm bright, I'm capable, I really apply myself, I work really hard, diligently, I just do everything, you know, completely well. I mean, after all, I went through high school in 1 year and college in a year and a half. And, you know, I just really could apply, know how to apply myself." And the abbot said, "Oh, well, in that case, it should take 20 years. So I believe in the teachings of the Buddha, he would not say that human nature was one way or the other. He would recognize that human nature is a mixed bag, and that variety of impulses, but that we need to take responsibility for the conditions that allow for the growth of those impulses or those movements within us, which are to our benefit and the benefit of others. And if you do that, my hope is you discover that within you there is a movement, an innate movement towards liberation and freedom. That is a self-liberating movement. And some people will experience that, have a sense of that self-liberating movement as a strong desire, a yearning, an intimation of a possibility that is all of our, hopefully something we can all have. Then the question is, when we sense that possibility or feel that yearning or that movement or that sense of gravitational pull towards liberation, do we listen to it or not? Do we allow for the, do we give the conditions for it to happen or not? Or do we go back to watching YouTube? Television. Or whatever else we might do. So, I hope that was stimulating enough that you'll think about this, your relationship to the topic of human nature, and perhaps this is an interesting topic to discuss with your friends and ask them what they think and explore it. I didn't offer my views here today as a definitive statement about this topic, but rather my really hope was to get you to think about your own views. And as you do that, try to reflect on how your own views, whether they're conscious or subconscious at this point, try to kind of unravel what you really believe. Are your views, do the views that you have limit you? Or do they make open the possibilities for something really beautiful to happen for you? So, thank you.